Jeffrey Brock has found inspiration in translating Italian poets such as Cesare Pavese, but his own poetry is also informed by American history, politics, and his family life with his two children and wife, the Canadian novelist Padma Viswanathan.
To see our life channeled through his poetry has been a thing of wonder.
You can hear some of this poetry, including one of his Bad Daddy poems, in the second half of our interview with the creative writing duo Jeffrey Brock and Padma Viswanathan, who both discuss the importance of translation today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. In 2015, Jeff and Padma made a quick trip to Kansas City from the University of Arkansas, where they both teach, to talk with students in UMKC's creative writing program. Both had recent books out. Hers, a Canadian novel just published in the U.S. by Soft Skull Press called The Ever After of Ashwin Rao, and his, a poetry book from Wayweiser Press in England, Voices, Bright Flags, winner of the Anthony Hecht Poetry Prize, which was named after one of our great U.S. Poets Laureate. Chosen by Heather McHugh for the social tapestry displayed in historical and dramatic monologues, like the one we heard in part one about John Brown, she no doubt also appreciated his humor, which was evident in his first poetry book, too. In fact, one of those poems, And Day Brought Back My Night, inspired an animation by Dan Wilkins that can be found online. So I got Jeffrey Brock to talk about his 2005 book, Weighing Light.
I can always find the poems in this book because they're in alphabetical order.
I know that a lot of people struggle with how to shape a book, but that solves that problem.
It does in a way, and sometimes it creates other problems too. And one of the reasons I ended up liking that solution is that these poems in this book particularly, I really want them to be sort of individual, freestanding poems. It's not a sequence. I feel that they can be read in almost any order, but you have to put it in a particular order for a book. And so one way of saying that they can be read in any order is to put them in alphabetical order, or random order. Having said that, though, it's not exactly as random as it looks, because I did feel after I put them originally in alphabetical order that there were a few jarring juxtapositions that I didn't like. And so in a few cases, I actually changed the titles to make them appear in a place that seemed a better place.
Oh, that is so fascinating to me. So you did, in fact, do a little ordering.
So it's not as arbitrary as it looks. But the arbitrary ordering also created a lot of juxtapositions that I liked. So this is called And Day Brought Back My Night. And the title, as some people will recognize, is stolen from the last line of a Milton sonnet. And day brought back my night. It was so simple. You came back to me, and I was happy. Nothing seemed to matter but that. That you had gone away from me and lived for days with him, it didn't matter. That I had been left to care for our old dog and house alone couldn't have mattered less. On all this, you and I and our happy dog agreed. We slept. The world was worryless. I woke in the morning, brimming with old joys, till the fact checker showed up late for work and started in. Item, it's years, not days. Item, you had no dog. Item, she isn't back. In fact, she just remarried. And oh yes, Item, you left her, remember? I did.
That's from the first book of poetry by Jeffrey Brock called Weighing Light, winner of the New Criterion Poetry Prize in 2005. And you're listening right now to New Letters on the Air. It's a wonderful collection. It's got a lot of personal poetry in it. We get a real sense of your humor in there.
I think humor is sometimes a neglected feature in serious poetry.
Jeffrey is here with his wife Padma, and you guys explore such different realms. Padma, you started out as a playwright, and some of your plays have been published. One is in Plays from the New West, Ethnicities. But now you're writing primarily fiction. You have a couple of novels to your name. You've written short stories. You also write essays. And then, Jeffrey, you're a poet primarily and a translator of other poets, particularly Italian poetry. You have an anthology of 20th century Italian poetry, and it is quite a tome. And it's not just translations by you, but you've gathered translations by numerous other people as well. Padma, did you watch Jeff do his translations? I mean, did that make you think, this is really worth pursuing?
Spending surprised it time. Didn't scare you off.
It should have. I mean, also, I have enormous admiration for Jeff. As Jeff with a poem is a pit bull with a piece of meat. I mean, he like tears these things down and rebuilds them. I mean, I am convinced watching him translate poetry that I could never translate poetry. I admit that. But
and why? You know, why? What is it?
There are just so many levels on which he works with formal poetry. So many fascinating questions. I mean, really fascinating to watch and to watch the translation come together. I mean, the way he writes his poems is often more mysterious to me because they seem to spring fully formed, whereas I'll see the translations in earlier and later drafts and so be able to see, you know, the skeleton and then the sinews and then the skin eventually that he'll put on this new creature that he's building out of this former creature.
Wow. Yeah.
That's better than I could have described it.
I know, that's pretty interesting. It's not just the language, but what they're trying to say and the nuances of what that language is conveying and then trying to pay tribute to whatever form it has as well, it seems like a daunting task to me.
I think you sort of have to start from the premise that it's an impossible task and then move on from there.
There you go. It's impossible, but I'm going to do this.
But we have to do it anyway, obviously. And I mean, poetry is also an impossible task. You know, literature in general, there's no perfection. Everything is a negotiation.
Futile.
Well, it's not
it's
necessarily.
It's a beautiful futility.
Everything
is a gorgeous, you know, necessary futility.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we talk about what you get out of translating other people's works?
I sort of started out learning to translate at the same time as I was sort of trying to write my own poems and trying to figure out how to become a poet. And I spent a semester abroad in Italy as an undergraduate, and so I was reading poetry and learning Italian at the same time, and so it was just sort of natural that I was try to read some Italian poetry and see what Italian poets were doing. And I just began translating as a way of reading, and it never occurred to me at that time that that would become part of my career as a writer, but I just never stopped doing it. And at a certain point, I realized that I wanted to publish a collection by the Italian poet Pavese, and that became my first book.
So an award-winning book, we should say.
It did very well, and because of the attention it got, I started getting offers to translate novels by Umberto Eco and a book by Roberto Colasso, things that I didn't seek out that just came to me as a result of the attention of that first book.
Why don't I have you read one of your translations?
Do you want me to read a Pavese poem?
Sure.
This is one of Pavese's most famous poems. It was a poem he wrote shortly before his own suicide. It doesn't have a title, but it's referred to by the first line, which is, "Death will come and will have your eyes."
Do you want to read the Italian first?
Okay. Verrà la morte e avrà i tuoi occhi. Questa morte che ci accompagna dal mattino alla sera, insonne, sorda, come un vecchio rimorso, un vizio assurdo. Death will come and will have your eyes. This death that accompanies us from morning till evening, unsleeping, deaf, like an old remorse or an absurd vice. Your eyes will be a useless word, a suppressed cry, a silence. That's how you see them each morning, when alone with yourself you lean toward the mirror. Oh, precious hope, that day we too will know that you are life and you are nothingness. Death has a look for everyone. Death will come and will have your eyes. It will be like renouncing a vice, like seeing a dead face resurface in the mirror, like listening to a lip that's shut. We'll go down into the maelstrom mute.
That's from the FSG Book of 20th Century Italian Poetry, an anthology that was edited by Jeffrey Brock. And we just heard his translation of a Pavese poem. We should also note that he has a book Pavese's Disaffections, Complete Poems, 1930 to 1950. Was that poem included in that book as well?
Yes, that's also in Disaffections from Copper Canyon, which came out in 2002.
Yeah, it got the MLA's Lois Roth Translation Award and the Penn Center USA Translation Award. So, Padma, let's talk about your drive to translate Brazilian literature. I have to say, you guys pick two gorgeous languages. You know, when you think of Italian and Portuguese, I mean, you can't get much more musical and beautiful than either of those. So, Padma, what first brought you to Brazilian writers?
It was a strange and very circuitous route. I first became interested in Brazil, not through its literature, but through its religious history. I was very interested in syncretic encounters, and Brazil has several traditions, which I was investigating, we can say. My part of India, South India, also has a very interesting set of syncretic tales. And so I was sort of tracking this in Brazil. This was in the early 90s. Right around the time that David Byrne started Luaca Bop, his record label, and he became very interested in Brazilian musicians, and suddenly you could get a hold of all this Brazilian music and international music generally. I mean, that was when the notion of world music became popular. People started talking about it, and I had just never heard this music before, and it completely sucked me in. So that was out of sort of an interest in this relatively arid subject, Brazilian religion. I came to Brazilian music and became very obsessed with it.
I love Brazilian music. I think it's gorgeous.
It's the most infectious.
Especially the folk music. Yeah.
It's so diverse. Also, I mean, I listen to a lot of, you know, Brazilian religious music as well as a lot of the pop music. And throughout the 20th century, Brazilian music is very varied. You know, it's very diverse. Also at that time, I was involved with Amnesty International, especially the Artist Network in Edmonton, and I met an Argentinian man.
Which we should say you're from British Columbia.
I was born in British Columbia. I was raised in Edmonton, Alberta, and I was living in Montreal when I met my American. And that's the reason I now am on this side of the border. But yeah, so that was my move across from Western to Eastern Canada. So I met this Argentinian now living in Edmonton who had survived torture under the dictatorship in Argentina and said, I would love to see a play written about human rights in my region. About a year later, I had finished working on House of Sacred Cows, which was my first play. And this guy, Luis, brought to Edmonton a Brazilian police officer to do training in community policing in Edmonton, of all places, in the middle of winter. It's January in Edmonton, which is the northernmost Canadian provincial capital. So it's minus 40 most days. You know, to have access to a Brazilian police officer as somebody who is interested in human rights, he was very candid. He was very unapologetic about describing the conditions that he faced as a police officer there. A year later, I was by this point living in Montreal. I got this grant. I was ready to try to write this play. I needed to learn Portuguese. I'm also a dancer, and I'd seen an ad in one of our community papers for Brazilian dance, and I went to this class, and I was the only person who showed up. And this woman still taught the class. She taught a wonderful full class, and I thought she was great, so smart, so funny. Her name is Sheila Ribeiro. And so then when I needed to learn Portuguese, I contacted the only other, you know, Brazilian person I'd met in Canada and said, would you teach me Portuguese? And she said, oh, I've always wanted to teach somebody Portuguese. So then I was her only Portuguese student, and Sheila has remained a very good friend of mine. I went down to Brazil for 10 weeks to do research toward that play. The play never materialized, but my research in Brazil deepened. And so then over the next few years, I went back two more times, once to manage a dance tour for Sheila. She's a choreographer primarily, and she needed somebody who could manage a tour, which I had done out of my theater background, and do it in Portuguese, which she felt I could do because she had taught me Portuguese. So I spent 10 weeks doing that. And then I went back another time 2 years later to do a residency at an artist's colony, again in northeast Brazil. And I'm most interested in the northeast. By this point, Jeff and I had met, we wanted to have children, and I needed still to have an outlet for my interest in Brazil in some way to keep up my Portuguese. And, you know, I'm not sure I have done that, but that was what really got me into Brazilian literature, that it was something I could do in the solitude of my study while still at home and still feel like I was having a deep engagement with Brazil. And most recently now I've been trying to translate the novel of a mid-20th century Brazilian novelist called Graciliano Ramos, who in Brazil is revered, but his reputation has not maintained outside of Brazil. And so many of his works have been translated. I think almost all of them were translated into English. Almost none of them are still in print, and translations often need updating. I think Jeff had told me at a certain point most translations need an update almost every generation. And so I'm trying to retranslate one of his novels.
And make him better known in this
rehabilitate
part of the
his
world.
Reputation. Yeah, exactly. I think he's amazing. And this has been this whole new delight to try to inhabit the minds that he creates. He's in the interior of the northeast of Brazil. It's a world I don't know very well, a voice that is so different from mine. And this is the great appeal with translation, is to get to try to enter the voice and mind of another writer.
That's one of the real pleasures of translating, is that you learn from all the people that you translate. You learn how they write. It's like taking a master class with them, a one-on-one, the way you learned Portuguese from Sheila. I learn how Pavese puts together a poem. And that's something that you never know exactly how it affects your own writing, but it presumably has some effect, some benefit. You have a broader range of understanding of tones and forms and voices.
Right. I'm Angela Elam, and I'm talking with the husband and wife team, Jeffrey Brock and Padma Viswanathan, today on New Letters on the Air. And Jeffrey Brock, the poet, has a new book out. This one is a winner of a prize as well, the 9th Anthony Hecht Poetry Prize. Are you a fan of Anthony Hecht's poetry?
Oh, I'm a huge fan. So that was, yeah, a particular pleasure to be associated with his name in that way. Some of my favorite poems of the 20th century are by Anthony Hecht.
The book's called Voices, Bright Flags. In this book, unlike your first book, which has so many personal things in it, not that this one doesn't. I mean, you've got a series of, what did you call them, bad daddy poems,
right,
which cracks me up. But you're also dealing with culture and some of the difficulties that we encounter over time, and you're tracing it through history. And then you've got one whole section of the book called Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about bringing the outer world and history and contemporary happenings into your work.
Yeah, it's a very different book from Weighing Light, a collection of more personal poems, more inward-looking poems, and Voices, Bright Flags is more outward-looking, I would say. And it's a book that, if it has a unifying theme, it's sort of my relationship with this country in some way. And some of the poems are more historical, research-based, and some are very personal, but they all share some sense of wanting to reflect or look at the times that we live in and what those times are haunted by. I see them as kind of companion books, the personal and the public, and they overlapped in composition. I had written some of the historical poems even before Weighing Light came out, and they just didn't really fit in that book. It took me a long time to finish this, in part because a lot of them did require research, in part because we had a couple of kids along the way and things like that.
Talking about the historical, I should give people a taste of some of the titles, because you have Wheatley in the Tower of London, 1773, talking about the poet Phyllis Wheatley, right. Whitman on Broadway in 1861, Monroe's Doctrine, 1865, Grant on his deathbed, 1885.
Right, and those are all titles from a sequence called Staring Back at Us, which is a sequence about the Civil War, and it's a series of 10 portraits of different figures that have something to do with the Civil War.
Being a Southern poet, you can't get away from the Civil War, can you?
Being American, you can't get away from it either. And I did grow up in the South and with parents who were Southern and who were very conscious of the history of the South and of the country. And so it has been a long preoccupation that colors a lot of things for me.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about this series called Homeland Security.
That's a series later in the book that is much more of a blend. What I'm trying to do is to sort of braid the personal and the political in those sections. And those were mostly written when our kids were very small. And whenever you have small kids, I think one of the things that you sometimes think about is what kind of world you're bringing them into. And so there are poems about my kids, particularly my son, and when he was small, some of them were written shortly after some of the news came out about Abu Ghraib and the atrocities there. And that kind of news, you know, anytime, but especially when you have a small kid, just makes you wonder about the world. And as a poet, I just feel compelled to write about those things.
Well, it makes sense to me because when you're dealing with a small baby, you're worried about what the world's going to be for them as they grow up. But I would be thinking every terrorist that began on this earth began as an innocent baby like this. How does this happen that we grow up killing each other?
And even if we don't grow up killing each other, what does it mean that other people are being killed in our name, you know, by our government or by our police officers or by representatives of our religion or things like that?
Yeah. I'm going to have you read three of these poems. We'll just have you read them in a row, Laku, Lods, and then Homeland Security.
Sure.
We're talking about all these heavy things, but this has some of your signature light touch intermingled with it, which I think will be nice for people to hear.
Good. Okay. I hope so. This is a sort of bitterly whimsical poem, maybe. I don't know how to describe it. The title is Laiku, and it's spelled like haiku, and it consists of two haiku stanzas. Laiku. Culture is nature. It isn't a disaster. There's no need to look. We do not torture. We did not trade weapons for I am not a crook. This is one of what I sometimes call my bad daddy poems, that for the first year or so after my son was born, I didn't write very many poems, but when I did write poems, they seemed to feature a crying child. This was also written in the wake of some of the Abu Ghraib news, and there's a lot of language from particularly Psalm 149 that works its way into this. Lauds. My eyes open to a cry, then flinch back shut. O Lord, make haste to help me. Why can't he wake up like the saints, joyful in glory? Let him sing aloud in his crib, but softly, one of those damn lullabies we always. Oh, harden not your heart. I feel it too, the urge to wake up screaming. Beneath the harps, beneath the timbrels, a nightmare noise, the chuckle of iron fetters, the snicker of our two-edged swords executing vengeance upon the heathen. Hear it? God's praise, like gristle in the swordsman's mouths. And thou, child, shalt be called the prophet. What's this now? Silence? Let Israel rejoice, and let thy father, who is still in bed, sleep a bit longer, and forgive him, and praise your screaming brethren, and not just those of Zion, for Christ's sake, for crying out loud. Before I read this, I usually gloss a couple of words. Diazepam is the generic name for Valium. Fipronil is a type of ant poison. And Fiddlebax is the colloquial name for the brown recluse spider. And we discovered a lot of those in our new house in Arkansas when we moved there with a small child, which was part of the sort of background of anxiety that this poem comes from. I'm no longer anxious about them, but in the first year or two, it was very stressful. It's called Homeland Security. The 4 a.m. cries of my son worm through the double foam of earplugs and diazepam. The smoke alarm's green eye glows. Beneath the cries, the squirm and bristle of the night's catch of fiddlebacks on the glue traps guarding our bed. Necrotic music, scored in my head. And all night, columns of ants have tramped through the ruins of my sleep, bearing the fipronil I left for them home to their queen. Patriot ants, out of republics endlessly perishing. If I can hold out long enough, maybe my wife will go. If she waits long enough, maybe he'll go back down on his own.
Three poems from the Homeland Security section of Voices, Bright Flags, the book by Jeffrey Brock. And Jeffrey is here with his wife Padma Viswanathan, and this is New Letters on the Air.
Last night we gave a reading together for some students. Some of them asked, how do you get ideas? I remember reading a piece by a fiction writer who had been at a writer's retreat with writers. One of them was Laurie Moore, and they all experienced this incident. Laurie Moore was the one person there who turned that incident into fiction. The writer who was writing about it wasn't exactly jealous, but said, this is how it works. Six different people will see something. I will be beside Jeff when he sees something, and it becomes a poem for him, whereas for me, it was something that simply passed.
And I love the way that he captures those scenes. In a page, you start out with an idea, and by the end of it, you've turned around the way you're seeing the situation. It's a craft and a gift, I think.
Yeah, so. I mean, the inspiration is never predictable. I mean, it also lets me see how he's reading, what he's reading, and obviously I find it instructive, even though I can never read like him, and even though our tastes overlap a lot in literature, but then there are also these sort of outlying territories, which is almost equally as interesting, the ways in which we disagree.
That's
when
interesting.
We disagree.
So
yeah.
What are you drawn to that he has no use for?
My favorite Chekhov story is one that he feels just doesn't hold together. For example, it's an anonymous tale, and I just love it. And I am deeply committed to my love for this. And some people call it a novella. And Jeff loves Chekhov, but does not love that story. I forced him to read it. You have to read this. He was teaching Chekhov one semester. I really feel that that story is undervalued, and Jeff does not feel it's undervalued. He feels it's pretty much, it has the reputation it deserves. He might be able to come up with a couple of other instances, but that was one that leaps to mind,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey, the last section of this book, Voices, Bright Flags, yep, is called Headlands, and it really deals a lot with nature. But there's one poem where the title for the book came out of it, so I thought I might have you read that.
Sure. Yeah, this poem is called Confluence, and it's set at a place near where I grew up, near Tallahassee, the Confluence of the St. Marks and the Wakulla Rivers. Confluence. Here on this tongue of land that laps the place where the St. Marks and the Wakulla come together, on grounds haunted by 1,000 years of the middens and the mounds of the Apalachee, here where Spaniards built a fort they called San Marcos, first of wood, burned down, again of wood, blown down, then at last of stone, which passed to England, then back to Spain, from whom Jackson snatched it, and of which only the foundations remain. Here, as I've been trying to say, upon these layered grounds, upon this speechless tongue, here, upon land that was everyone else's before and after it was ours, the woman I loved and I came down to the water's edge at dusk, as thirsting animals will, a woman I later looked for in other women and in myself. And we were the latest triumphant army. We ruled the conquered dead a while, voices, bright flags rippling from our throats, bodies, twin rivers spilling together toward the gulf, rivers from whose brackish currents we may never stop drinking.
Confluence, from Jeffrey Brock's collection, Voices, Bright Flags, winner of the 9th Anthony Hecht Poetry Prize from the Wayweiser Press in England. The book was also named a 2014 Book of the Year by TLS, Times Literary Supplement, an international weekly for literary culture. Brock also read from his first poetry book, Weighing Light, a 2005 winner of the New Criterion Poetry Prize, and from his prize-winning book of translations of Cesar Pavese poems called Disaffections from Copper Canyon Press. To find out more about the creative pair, Jeffrey Brock and his wife Padma Viswanathan, listen to the other half of this 2015 interview on our website, newletters.org. There you can find links to their books and hear Padma read from her two novels, The Toss of a Lemon and The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. You can also sign up for our free weekly podcast under the Ways to Listen tab or find us in the iTunes store. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Coy Duggar, Elizabeth Albano, Sean Weir, Nick Shea, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.